You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, in the Social Coffee House in Bogota's Rosales neighborhood, very well-heeled and leafy area. This episode 163, I could say, is in front of a live audience because we're here in front of the coffee house patrons, I guess. And we're here with Laura Brown. Without further ado, Laura, welcome on Columbia Calling.
Thanks, Richard. It's nice to be on the show again.
Yes, and you're on the other side of the show because avid listeners to Columbia Calling will know that Laura was the guest host of episode 155, which was an interview about bird watching in Colombia with Chantelle Duplessis.
Duplessis.
I've got to get it right.
But
we've got you on the show, not only because it's just nice to have you back on the show and put you in the hot seat. As a journalist, you don't like this. You prefer to be on this side
of the
mic.
Right, exactly. You used to be the one asking the questions.
And also creating trouble. That's what we mean. But it's been a tumultuous week, it has, hasn't it, folks? I mean, doesn't matter where you stand on the political spectrum, it's pretty interesting to have watched the elections in the US this last, 9-11 or
11-9? Well, yeah, exactly. It is interesting, the dates.
It's interesting, and who knows? And I think there's a lot of discussion down the line that we could definitely do about what this means to Latin America and Colombia, but I don't think that's for today. I think we need to let the dust settle a little bit more and talk about what I have you on the show for. But and then what we want to talk about in a minute or two will be, let's do a comparison about South Africa's peace process and Colombia's peace process. Because, you know, a few episodes ago we recorded with Ian McCaffrey, who's down there in Cali, but about Northern Ireland and Colombia, and it was very popular and very well received. And I think there's a lot that you can share as a South African native. I know you were born in Zimbabwe, but you are a South African native, and you definitely have, opinions.
I do. There's a lot to talk about. It's something that has always interested me, just the similarities between the two countries and the whole peace process, and also with Zimbabwe, about the struggle for independence, becoming independent, and what South Africa went through as well.
And of course, we've Zimbabwe with, were we describing him as a gentleman, Robert Mugabe, in control?
Well, he's very happy about Trump winning the election, so that's will be interesting to see what that brings about.
I could see them, playing blackjack together in Atlantic City. I could see Mugabe in that role. I think he's still the man with the last facial hair faux pas, no? The last Hitler moustache.
No, he doesn't age either. he doesn't age.
You know, I was told years ago that he was going to die of syphilis by someone, but he's still here.
That was the rumor a few years ago.
Well, let's wind back, Laura. Let's talk a little bit about you first. You're a journalist, you're formally trained, you write for the Bogota Post and for publications in South Africa.
Yeah, I write for a number of publications in South Africa.
Excellent. No, but tell us a bit about yourself, how you ended up here in Colombia, because people will be saying South African lady in Colombia.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, I've travelled a lot since I was a child, I guess. Due to my parents' work, there was always a lot of moving around. I was born in Zimbabwe and lived there until my early teens when I moved to Switzerland and went to boarding school in England. And later settled in South Africa and then, got bit by the travel bug again and ended up in South America. So I basically spent a few years back and forth between various parts of South America. I've lived in Chile, Brazil, and spent several months traveling through Argentina, a little bit of Peru as well. And then I ended up in Colombia 2 years ago. I came here after the World Cup in Brazil, which I was out working for some South African newspapers. And then, I guess it just was kind of time to stop moving. And I happened to be here. I liked it. It's a good place to be.
Yeah, I know all too well.
It's an easy place to get stuck.
I'm no longer stuck.
You're no longer stuck. Yeah, you're here. Yeah. You're settled.
I have a life here.
Yeah, you
have a life. Children and stuff. Child, sorry. But, but yes, I'm no longer stuck. But at one point I would have said stuck. Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. Yeah.
This has been the longest period of time then, 2 years ago. I mean, it's a long period of time, really.
It is a long time. Yeah. And it is, I guess, it's the longest I've stayed in one place for a while.
Yeah, so you're settled. You're settled in Colombia.
I am, I'd say.
What do your parents think of this then?
Obviously they miss me.
Of course.
I have to say that's the one thing that I really dislike about living here. It's just the distance and the price of the airline ticket to South Africa. Because you need...
Why do you just fly to?
You can fly, the easiest route would be via Sao Paulo. But there are no good connections, so either way, like whichever way you go, you need 2 days.
Yeah.
You need to set aside 2 days to travel. And the price is like basically think of, anywhere you would go in Europe, say Frankfurt, London, Paris, and double it. So that's what you're looking at, exactly. No. So that's the one thing that I really dislike about living here, just the... just the sheer logistics of...
And on a freelance journalist's wage.
Nah, it doesn't work.
Throw some money at her, folks.
Exactly, throw some money this way.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. But for you living here, obviously it's been a pleasant experience.
And it's especially a great time to be here, I think, with all the changes. Colombia's a fast emerging economy.
Uh-huh.
The way the country's growing in terms of tourism, there's so many interesting things to do here. There's so many interesting things to see, to visit. And also, with the political scene as well.
It's fascinating.
It's extremely. I mean, it's the time to be here.
It is the time to be here. Yeah. I think it's probably the most exciting time, as we go into this transition. Although there has been a pretty negative piece out of the Financial Times this week about... the extension of the peace dialogues is scaring off foreign direct investment.
Wow.
But it will come.
It will come.
It's a process, isn't it?
Whenever there's change, there's always a big kind of panic and withdrawal of finance and holding out. But then it comes back.
And this, of course, brings me to the crux of the interview.
Okay.
Because it is that. You've seen with your own eyes. You've obviously clearly experienced it, and your parents have experienced it. A real period of transition.
Right, that's right.
Can you give us a little bit of a background then on South Africa? I am pretty ignorant about South Africa.
Yeah.
I know Kenya a little bit, Tanzania.
Yeah.
But South Africa is not, despite having shared a house with a South African girl for a year, I still don't know very much about it. And, how would you say that, the sort of peace agreement unfurled there in South Africa?
Well, one of the things, before I really get into talking about the peace agreement in South Africa, I just want to say that something that has always fascinated me was just the similarities between Colombia and South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting, the last couple of countries that I've lived in, because before Colombia I was based in Brazil for a little while. And the three countries are so similar in terms of, not in terms of population, because Brazil's population is massive, but Colombia and South Africa share very similar populations. The population of South Africa is about 52 million, and Colombia about, 47 million?
Yeah, around there.
And we have very similar GDPs as well, with the GDP of Colombia's GDP per capita income at $7.8 US, and South Africa's at 6.6, and the GDP of Colombia is at around $378 billion, with South Africa's around $350 billion.
And based on prime materials, I imagine.
Yeah.
Mining, diamonds,
right,
etc.
Exactly.
Here, like emeralds and so on. Very interesting then. Very similar.
Yeah, very, very similar. And I also think that the like the social structures as well, you know, walking around, just looking at people and the way that the way the society is built, I think the people are very similar.
Yeah.
You know, like you have, on the one hand, I could say that, like physically looking around, the like the racial mixes of people are like similar looking to what you would see in South Africa. And also the like in terms of economic, like the difference between the poor and the rich is also very similar. That South Africa and I think South Africa and Colombia are ranked very close to each other on the Gini index. I forget right now what the exact ranking is, but they're like they're a few points apart.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. A definite similarity there. And would you say the social structure, like the elites, and then you know, sort of like you know, ranking down, sort of growing middle class with a spending ability, but being strangled a bit at this moment in time.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I'd say that's very very similar to South Africa, where you know you do have this you have this elite which is pretty much holding on to power and will do pretty much what they can to hold on to that power.
Yeah.
It is in their best interests to keep themselves at the top of the, you know, at the top of the pyramid and keep the others down, which is, I mean, it is unfortunate. And yeah, even in the way that you see the, like, kind of rich Colombians with their maids and housekeepers and, you know, like the kind of lady of the manor, you know, sitting around being served upon. Also very similar in South Africa. You get the same kind of thing. And also, I guess, in terms of education, that that the elite will send their kids to private school and kind of keep things in that. Although I think on that, in that respect, that South Africa is a lot, is not as bad as Colombia in terms of like keeping the elite class as it is. I guess like maybe it's not as strongly developed in South Africa, whereas in Colombia you've got, you know, like generations and generations and it doesn't change very much. Whereas in South Africa there is more of a growing like a growing kind of middle and upper class. Yeah.
That's interesting to hear. So then there's hope.
There is hope. There is a bit of mobility.
There is
definitely a little bit of mobility. And yeah, hopefully this, we could say the same about Colombia.
I think there's hope. I mean, it's a tough one, you know. And when you brought up education there, I'm not going to spring any questions on you because, but you know, I've started investigating for my son.
Yeah.
And it's kind of terrifying. I mean, that's the truth of it.
No, it is. It's insane.
Yeah.
A good school here, a good private school, is like costs more per month than I make per month.
Oh yeah.
So how are you going to send your kids to school?
Well, I don't know.
No?
I'm now deciding I'm going to best that hurdle when I come to it. I don't know.
How old is your boy?
18 months.
18 months.
But equally, you know, in this area of town as well, just next door, there's a nursery school. We're the closest nursery school, and we're thinking of starting to send him next year.
Yeah.
And it will cost $800,000 a month.
Wow.
You know, that's a significant chunk of change.
It is.
And that's the cheapest we've seen in this area.
Wow.
I'm not lying. There's one over there for $1,200,000. There's another one down the hill, $1,400,000.
Wow.
That's per month. But you have to pay a fee to get in.
Wow.
You know, and it's almost like it's almost as if there's a requirement for the parents. They ask you for your level of education and your income. And I'm like, this is nursery school,
right?
You know,
exactly. I'd so somebody, keep the riffraff out.
Yeah.
You don't want any uneducated parents sending their kids for education,
which I found quite invasive. You know, that it is like what educational level,
right?
But anyway,
so it kind of goes back to what I was saying, that you know, of wanting to keep the class system as it is, keep the classes where they are. If you haven't been educated, then your kid doesn't get to get educated either.
Stifling the mobility. Wow. But I'm happy to hear that South Africa has that. But would you say that's? I mean, this mobility, this changing. It's been coming what would you say, it's a result of the negotiations, and or is it something that's already there, it's already rippling beneath the surface?
I'm not sure if you're maybe misunderstanding me when I say that there is mobility. I think you're kind of maybe thinking a lot more mobility than really actually exists. Because although, yes, there is mobility in terms of, like, as we're talking about education, that private school is not the only option. Okay. And super expensive private school is definitely not the only option. There are also some decent public schools.
Okay.
Depending on where you live, in certain areas, like especially in rural areas and also parts of the city, that the schools will be very bad, but there are also some very good schools which are accessible.
Okay.
So in that respect, but in terms of mobility, the class system still remains pretty much as it is, and unfortunately in South Africa that is more or less based upon racial lines. So you still have most of the power, most of the money owned by white people.
Yeah.
And most of the people living in poverty are black. As I said, that, you know, the education does exist, like, you know, as far as high school and things like that. At the moment, South Africa has been, like, for about the past year, or maybe a little bit more than a year, there's been a big movement called Fees Must Fall.
Okay.
Where the students, university students, have been fighting for, against paying tuition fees.
Nice.
Yeah. And it started in the last academic year, where eventually the government conceded to, they didn't drop tuition fees, but they didn't increase them for the next year. So that was kind of a small step.
Okay.
So some people were happy with that, and then, but not everybody. And the battle has pretty much been going on for the whole year, and now it's getting to the end of the academic year, because the year in South Africa is from January to November, December. Mm-hmm. And in most of the major universities, students haven't been able to do exams because there's been rioting, there's been protesting. Students have, you know, like blocked entrance to the university, just demanding that the fees must fall.
Yeah.
And because you do have, and it's also interesting to see within that movement, like, who is for it and who's against it, because you've got the, you know, like the kids of those who have money, who are saying, well, you know, but it's not fair. Why can't we go to university? Why can't we write our exams?
Yeah.
We've paid our fees.
Huh.
Whereas you've got, you know, like the kids coming from poorer backgrounds who are saying, well, you know, we're never going to be able to, like, it's got nothing to do with academic ability, but, you know, just about being able to pay the fees.
Yeah, but it's a tricky situation.
It is.
It's tricky, and of course it won't go away,
you
know, because at some point they're going to want to increase those fees again.
Right.
I mean, at some point, so
exactly.
It'll keep, you know, keep the people down type thing. But, well, thank you for that. I mean, you're giving us a background to South Africa, which here, you know, we don't get here in Colombia, of course. It's not our sphere of influence, really, but... I think this is a good point to take a short break.
Okay.
And we'll be back, and we'll continue with you, Laura Brown, journalist from South Africa, talking to us here on Columbia Calling, this episode 163. She's on the other side of the microphone this time, but it's really interesting. It's really interesting to hear, because we can compare with Colombia.
We can.
I think this is very important.
Yeah.
And especially in Colombia, where we tend not to compare so much.
Right.
You know, so we'll take a short break if any of you have any questions or anything. We're always open to emails. That's columbiacalling@gmail.com. Of course, the website, columbiacallingradio.com, and Twitter. You can abuse us there @columbiacalling. So don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is episode 163 of Columbia Calling. And as you know, because you've been listenings thus far. We're talking to Laura Brown. We're here in the Social Coffee House in Rosales. So, you know, check it out. It's a really nice new coffee house. It's been here for about 3 months or so.
Okay.
The owner is Colombian, and she's come back because of the change in Colombia. She's come back.
That's so, something that's also interesting that we need to talk about at some point. Well, okay. All the people coming back. Because of the change.
And I think that will be the success story in the end, you know, when more people come back. And I'm sure that's something that's happened in South Africa, because of course...
Not to the same extent as here, although there are a few people coming back here.
Sorry, you know, to invest, seeing the change, seeing the positivity. Exactly. It's a good feeling, you know, to talk about people who, you know, had to flee at a certain point. Yes. Now, you know, being able to come back. But, I mean, let's get to the well, hang on a second. We are here in the Social Coffee House, and you are drinking South African tea.
I'm drinking South African tea, which I was really excited to find that they serve rooibos here.
There you go.
So... yeah, anyone who's listening and who's missing their rooibos fix, you can come and get some at the Social Coffee House.
There we go. So it's all about a coffee house with rooibos tea.
Rooibos tea.
But it's, you know, makes a nice change.
Yeah.
But let's talk about this a little bit. So the peace agreement started, let's say, the negotiations in 1990.
In South Africa, They did go on from around 1990. They had probably started a little bit before that, but I think officially... the dates are around 1990. In 1990 was when Nelson Mandela was released from prison. Yeah. And so there had obviously already been a lot of negotiation before that, leading up to that time. And so probably between 1990 and 1993 was the kind of main part of the negotiations.
So we're looking at 3 years, but of course there would have been previous, you know, negotiations, and then post as well, because
No, it doesn't. It doesn't just go away.
And so it's de Klerk who was in charge.
De Klerk was one of the main drivers, I'd say. Yeah. Obviously, with trying to forge through a path towards peace with the ANC and other parties involved.
The African National Congress,
yes, is the ANC, which is the party that that most famously Nelson Mandela belonged to. Uh-huh. And it's the party that has been in power in South Africa since 1994, which is when the first democratic elections, the first free elections were held. In South Africa, and which is when Nelson Mandela was elected and became the first democratically elected president.
It was a landslide
of South
as well.
Africa. I mean, it was a landslide. It was, yeah. It was.
And so these negotiations, I mean, to put it into a Colombian context, so we're looking at 3+ years of negotiations. What were the key, do we have key points that were negotiated, that hit the table, let's say?
You know, one of the things that I think we have to keep in mind is that the ANC was considered a terrorist party.
Yeah.
And the, what is it called? The National Party? I think the de Klerk's party was the National Party, which was, which was in charge. You know, obviously they believed that what they were doing was right. And so when you look at the way that the negotiations have been folding out in Colombia, it's, you know, you always have one side believing that everything that they're doing is right, and then the other side saying that no, that they're wrong, because, you know, of whatever reason. So I guess the key points in the South African context were to free political prisoners, because there were I don't know how many, but there were hundreds, probably thousands of people who were imprisoned simply for speaking against the government, simply for being black, for being on the wrong side, you know, being found on the wrong street at the wrong time, for, you know, choosing to be married to someone who they shouldn't have, because, you know, that, like, mixed marriages were also illegal during that time. So I think those were kind of the main points. The main points were to free people, because we were living in a very extreme time.
Oppressive.
Very oppressive. Yeah, very oppressive time.
But in terms of conflict, I mean, how you wouldn't draw too many similarities about an armed conflict, guerrilla warfare, or because I know that, you know, I know there were militant groups on both sides.
But there were militant groups on both sides, and there were occasional bombings. It's hard to. I don't think we can really compare the two. The two armed conflicts between what happened in South Africa and what happened in Colombia. Probably if you talk to someone who's a, like more of a military specialist or a historian, then they would be able to tell you a lot more about that, and you probably would find a lot of similarities. But in terms of just the way that the war was fought in Colombia, in terms of it, a lot of it being more out kind of in the jungle, in the rural areas, a lot of kidnappings, things like that. That's not something that really happened in South Africa.
Right.
In South Africa, it was more a case of people people who wanted to, like, who sort of took a stand against the oppressive regime, who would, you know, then be thrown into prison, and then their groups, their peers, would rebel by maybe, you know, planting a bomb somewhere. We would have to look at the statistics of how many people were killed during that time, but I don't think it would compare to Colombia.
It's a different
it was a different type of war.
A type of conflict.
Yeah, a different type
on,
of conflict,
on the ground
yeah.
there. But when we see the images, or let's say when the BBC does their witness program, for example, they talk about the massacres that took place. Was it Soweto?
Soweto. I think that was 1976 was the big, that was actually the big uprising that, and that's when the world started to pay attention.
Because it made the front page.
Exactly.
There is that image, isn't it? The father carrying his son.
Hector Peterson.
There we go.
I
couldn't have.
And so what happened at that time was that the students were told that they had to learn in Afrikaans, that that would be the main language that they would be taught in. Afrikaans is the Dutch-based language, which came from, but it's actually originally from South Africa, but it's similar to Dutch.
It's childish Dutch, because my friend from Holland, listened to it, it's like a baby talk.
Like a baby talk.
They'd love that, the Afrikaans.
I don't know, because I don't speak Afrikaans.
But good.
Yeah. And so they were told that they had to learn in Afrikaans, and the students refused. And so they protested peacefully, and the police came and just opened fire and shot down. I don't remember how many were killed. I want to say 30-something, but I couldn't really be sure of that figure. And that was, basically when that made the front pages, that was when the world started to
sit up and
say, hey, what's going on? What's going on in South Africa?
And then I mean, that's when you had, the sort of popular culture getting involved as well. They were saying, you know, we're not going to go on tour. We're not going to do this because we're not going to, apartheid and all this. We can't go. Very interesting to see
that. There was this big anti-apartheid movement that like, kind of took place around the world. I just want to point something out. We were talking about like comparing the wars in the two countries. And I also just need to point out that South Africa didn't actually have a war at that time. Although the, I'm not sure what we should call it, the conflict, it was building up towards a war.
Really?
Yeah, it was. And if, I think the negotiating parties, including de Klerk, knew that if they didn't come to an agreement at that time, that it was going to explode.
So you had this conflict, let's say, they would call it kind of like disturbances, but leading up to a war, where there could have been the sparks.
It was leading up to that. Like, you know, people were being trained. Foot soldiers were being trained.
Really?
Yeah.
White supremacists and everything.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Tough. So, I mean, that's so. It was a preventative measure.
It was.
Not to allow it get into a situation like here 52 years later. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's not something I thought about. I mean, I guess the war prior to that was the Boer War.
The Boer War, yes. Yeah, the Boer War. The Anglo-Saxon War. I don't know. I'm not too good at history, so I can't go that far back.
But it's fine. So, I mean, you know, you spent, let's say, those formative years outside of South Africa, but were your parents in South Africa at the time when this was all going on?
I had family there, and so I spent a lot of time visiting. I didn't actually live in South Africa during that time, but I would have spent a lot of time visiting family there. So I did see and experience firsthand what was happening.
Right.
When the I remember the actual first free election, I was in London at the time. Uh-huh. And so we all kind of piled into Trafalgar Square to celebrate, because that's where the South African embassy was.
Is it still there?
Probably. I'm not too sure, actually. I think it is there still.
That's usually a big
flag. Yeah. So that was kind of the big party, was in Trafalgar Square, where we went and celebrated that Mandela had been elected.
Yeah. So we talk about that. We've got the movie, the Mandela movie with Matt Damon. What's it called?
Invictus.
How much did the Rugby World Cup have to do and winning it then with tying South Africa together? How was a sporting event? Was it a catalyst?
It's hard to say. You know, sport in South Africa is also divided. Rugby is more of a white sport. It is changing a little bit more now. Like, now you do see, if you look at the supporters in the stadium, you do see a more dark faces than you would have, like, say, probably 10 years ago. And definitely that time, 20 years ago, you didn't see any at all. So rugby was a typically white sport. And I suppose the culture that went around, that went with it, would also have been associated with, let's say a certain type of fascism, a certain type of person who would play or
be very diplomatic.
Rugby.
I mean, and that's fine. I'm all right with that.
It was a big question of as to whether or not Mandela would allow that to the World Cup to take place. Being it was a white sport, and he did, which I think was quite a bold move as well, because it did kind of bring a little bit of unity.
Yeah, I bet it did. I mean, that's the simplistic way of thinking. So, you know, Colombia just has to win the World Cup, made it football, soccer,
right?
And then everything will be resolved. You know, just in the South African model,
right?
But
exactly.
I don't want to trivialize this, but the movie made out, of course, that's Hollywood, but it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, it was Hollywood, but I think also a lot of it, like, probably did reflect a lot of what was happening at the time.
Captain Francois Pina.
Francois Pina. Yeah.
But the black player was Chester Williams.
Williams,
yeah. The one black player on the team.
Right.
Of course, that was the townships.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting situation, you know. I'm definitely learning right here talking to you.
Right.
I feel a bit embarrassed about my ignorance.
Yes.
I know a lot about Colombia. But so, I mean, you know, let's say that the agreement's signed, 94, Mandela is elected, things start to change. When you revisited South Africa after the elections and after these momentous events, how did it feel? I mean, were people disappointed that it wasn't changing fast enough?
I think the first years after, there was a lot of excitement. Everything felt fresh, and you could kind of feel the change, like feel that things were happening. I think even the years before, I'm trying to think when I think I was there. Summer of 93. Uh-huh. Yeah, so, I was there at 93, so that was just before the first election. And you could already feel that things were changing. There was a dynamic. There was definitely a dynamic. And then afterwards, you know, if you went in the, like, kind of mid-90s, there was a lot happening. There was a lot of change.
And then security-wise, because I know the Colombians are worried, of course, of this mass, let's say, repopulation of cities and towns by people who know little else than sort of violence their whole life.
Yeah.
I mean, how is South Africa?
This is a problem. South Africa is, we do have a problem of violent crime. There is a lot of violent crime, and I'm not really sure why. Possibly because of the oppression and violence that so many people experienced. But it's hard to understand it, because if you look at a lot of other countries that have suffered, I have to say that that's one of the first things that really struck me in Colombia is just how resilient people are. You know, like having been through like over 50 years of war, you would kind of expect people to, I don't know, look very like depressed and downtrodden. But that's not really the case. I'm sure it is in certain areas that have been hit very badly. But like kind of walking around, you know, the average person is like, you know, like looks happy and is getting on with life. And that's something that, that really struck me. But no, going back to the problem of crime in South Africa, I think a lot of it does, in my opinion, it goes back to the inequality. The inequality, you know, if you have so many people, if you have, because I'd say that the majority are living in poverty.
Yeah.
And then people are looking at all, you know, these other riches, which they're just never going to have, and they become angry. And also people are very angry about, you know, the government made a lot of promises to them, which were not fulfilled, you know, like promises for such as housing, education, healthcare.
The usual.
Exactly, the usual.
The things that matter
right.
to someone who's of, let's say, a precarious financial situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this is something that also... you know, could potentially be a problem for Colombia.
I think so.
Because the government has also made all those promises of what they're going to give to people. At this stage, the promises have been more to the, you know, to the ex-guerrillas.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who are not ex-guerrillas, who are also living in poverty, are also going to become angry and are going to want,
resentment.
You know, exactly, the resentment and... yeah, that's something that has has been very difficult for South Africa.
Yeah, I can imagine. So if you just let me know, I mean, mm-hmm. those townships, because that's the word,
yeah,
isn't it? The
townships
that we saw or used to see, they still exist.
Are they still, they definitely still exist, yeah. Yeah, they
so definitely still exist. It's a tough situation.
They still exist and they won't go away because the thing is you have... as in most countries, you have this mass urban migration with people looking for jobs. And so forth. And yeah, this is, I see a very similar scenario happening in Colombia as well. And, you know, there you have people who are living without running water, without electricity. You have, you know, all the social problems that go with living in such poor conditions.
Basic needs are not being catered for.
No.
But as we wind this down, as we wind this interview down, because it is really interesting, but I said, let's see, what advice could you give as a South African, having seen these processes, having lived through an era, really, again, an interesting era?
Yeah.
It takes us back kind of to the beginning. It's an exciting time to be in Colombia, but you were in South Africa in some exciting times.
Mm.
But what would be your advice to Colombians, you know, as I, you know, Santos hopes to have something signed by Christmas, let's say.
Yeah.
I think Colombians expect everything to be like
to happen quickly.
Quickly. And I think, you know, these things take time.
I'd say, yeah, like you say, that these things do take time, but also not, you know, they shouldn't take too much time. This has been a problem in South Africa that 20 years down the line, we're still looking at pretty much the same problems.
Right.
One thing that I think that we really struggle with in South Africa is unity. The country is so so fragmented, you know. It's like each, not necessarily each person, but each group is looking out for their own interests. You know, like I said, for example, the example that I gave earlier about the university students, it's kind of like, well, we've paid, so why can't we study? The same thing, you know, I have a conversation with people. Public transport in South Africa is terrible. It's terrible. Like, your priority, if you can afford it, is to get a car. That's something that I love here, is that, you know, like, complain as much as you like about the Transmilenio, the bus system, and all the rest of it, but at least it exists and you can use it. And if I, you know, if I talk to someone in South Africa and say that, oh, yeah, it's, you know, it's such a pain that we don't have public transport here, the standard answer will be, but you have a car. So people aren't really looking out for each other. People are like kind of looking out for themselves. So I think that would be the biggest piece of advice that I would give to Colombia, that you need to be unified. You need to move forward together. don't, you know, like, step away from this elite bubble that kind of is a driving force, especially in Bogota. I'm not too sure in the other cities. I think it does exist, probably a lot more so here. And I think that's the thing that really breaks the nation. That's the thing that breaks South Africa, in my opinion.
Really? Wow, that's a strong point. And so finally, if my listeners out there wanted to learn more about South Africa, is there some literature that you can recommend that would be sort of, let's say, not too academic, you know, maybe, I don't know, Cry the Beloved Country is a very, very famous book.
It's a very famous book.
And a movie with Sidney Poitier, I think, that I've seen.
It's a very famous book. Yeah. It's also very old, and it was one of the books that you had to read at school.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure if those are the ones that you really recommend.
The Power of One,
that was also great. That was also great. I have to think about it. I can't think.
It was my secret surprise question. No, but I wouldn't do that to you. If there are any, you know, you can send them to me and I'll put them up on the Facebook page.
I'll send you some.
Let me just say thank you for sharing with us, you know, some really interesting insights into comparisons and stuff, because I just don't think that they're made enough here.
Yeah.
You know, again, I really don't. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to learn. So this is, you know, thank you, Laura, for your time.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
You're most welcome.
It's been nice talking to you.
On the other side of the mic, I think next time you'll be on, you'll be doing your own show again. I'd love to have you back. But this has been episode 163. We've been talking to journalist Laura Brown from South Africa, and we've been comparing issues in South Africa and Colombia. And I think that's been really, for me, it's been an enriching experience. I hope for those of you out there, you've learned something or, you know, something to take away as a conversation topic. Of course, get in touch, as always. That's ColombiaCalling@gmail.com, ColombiaCallingRadio.com, @ColombiaCalling if you're a Twitter person. And that's us. That's us for 163. We will be back next week talking to another fascinating interviewee on 164. So thank you for listening. Bye-bye.